and welcome to episode 62 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, a.k.a. Cookie.
And I'm Paul, a.k.a. Retrod.
And this week we'll be discussing several things. Crossover all the things, as the X-Files universe is set to cross with Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Crow and Ghostbusters, and potentially more. Microsoft shows off Xbox One's gamer profile and social features. Terminator 5 could be inspired by Batman Begins if words of rumoured, not confirmed, director Alan Taylor are anything to go by. And Watch Dogs won't be out until spring 2014.
Plus, for our feature this week, we have an exclusive interview, because nobody else is interviewing at the moment, interview with Dread and Limitless composer Paul Leonard Morgan.
All the excites.
Yay! Very much the excites.
Another Paul.
Another Paul.
Yay.
Somebody's going to start saying something about me and the name Paul at some point.
You're basically catching us like Pokemon. You can have this little balls and going, "Yay! Go, Balls. Cookie!"
I'm not going to make a ball joke.
Why is this one hairy?
I wasn't going to. Okay, do you know what? I think it's time to talk about this crossover craziness that's madness happening with the X-Files.
Cookie, no, it's not.
Cookie, you found this, didn't you? You were just...
I did.
You were casually...
I'm to blame.
You were casually perusing the internet last week, and you were what the hell is this? And what the hell is it, Cookie, would you say?
It's basically... I think it's IDW that are doing it.
Yep.
They decided to do a massive crossover of all of the franchises they currently own. Well, pretty much most of the big ones anyway. So apparently we're going to have a crossover of The X-Files, when Ghostbusters, The Crow, Transformers, and My Little Pony. No, that's the wrong one. What was the other one?
There's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, yes, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Sorry, yes.
Yeah.
So that was stuck in the back of my mind. Apparently what's going to happen is there's going to be a virus or disease that starts to threaten humanity, and Mulder and Scully and the lone
gunman
are going to be looking at urban myths to help try and help solve, get a cure and save humanity. And these urban myths happen to be for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that are supposedly living in the sewers, the Ghostbusters, I'm not quite sure how they're an urban myth, and Transformers, obviously the robots that turn into other vehicles, and also the Crow, the vengeance spirit.
See, my problem is that to have a good crossover, because there have been good crossovers before, to have a good crossover, you have to have an independent universe and having everything, you know, filter into it, rather than having one established universe and kind of crossing over with different stories.
Yeah,
so, I mean, say for example, Smash Bros. That works because it's a, you know, it's its own universe, and everything just kind of pours into there. And I think there's several other, you know, kind of franchises and whatnot. Kingdom Hearts is another example where they've got a lot of different Disney stuff and a lot of different Final Fantasy stuff, and it's its own universe, so it kind of works. But
even with Infinite Crisis with DC and Marvel, that actually worked quite well.
Sorry, did you say Infinite Crisis?
Yeah, with DC and Marvel.
Or do you mean the Versus type thing that happened in the 90s?
Is it that one? There was when the...
Were you talking about the video game where it was DC and Mortal Kombat?
No, that was...
No, that's more recent.
There was a DC and Marvel crossover where they sort of seeped into each other's universe.
That was the thing that happened in the 90s.
Mm.
And there was, like, votes on who would win.
Mm.
Is this where you're going to make us feel very old?
I only know of it through hearsay and Wikipedia.
What, you only know from hearsay?
This exists, and Wikipedia, and, you know, technically you would kind of class Wikipedia as hearsay, unless you managed to track down all the references. So
I never read it, I wasn't into
comics. I did actually... No, because they're doing that game now, aren't they?
Sorry?
They're doing the MMO Infinite Crisis on DC, aren't they?
They're doing Infinite Crisis as an MMO?
Yeah.
What,
is that DC Injustice Online? Or something?
No, Infinite Crisis video game.
No. Oh, God, no, God.
Multiplayer online battle arena. Woo!
I mean, even the Mortal Kombat vs. DC Universe, its story was not that great because
it was the Mortal Kombat vs. DC Universe, I'd say.
Well, I think it would have been better if it was set as its own universe and the characters from each universe were pulled into this third one.
Hmm.
You know, that would have made far more sense than, oh, Shokan is defeated at the same time as Darkseid and somehow they fused.
Do you know what? The weirdest thing that came up whilst researching this news was the fact that there's been a Punisher and Archie crossover. A Punisher and Archie crossover.
That would only be satisfactory if he killed everyone.
What, Archie?
Oh yeah, why not? Yeah. He's always the quiet ones.
Yeah, you've always got to watch him, haven't you?
The just about the only decent crossover I can think of, which wasn't a more obvious one, like there were the Aliens versus Predator comics.
Oh, and Batman in the 90s. And like Aliens and Predators.
Batman versus Predator.
Yeah.
Which actually worked quite well because if you think about it, one's a hunter that uses lots of gadgets, and the other is the Predator.
Yeah.
That uses lots of gadgets.
That uses lots of gadgets.
Also, that whole Batman Judge Dredd thing that happened way back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody's got memories of it. I can't wait anymore.
Yeah. there are seldom good reasons for crossovers apart from how can we sell to this demographic?
I have to admit, because obviously okay, so the review for issue 4 of X-Files season 10 hasn't gone up on Hex yet, but I have read it, and I've got issue 5 waiting to be read, and obviously that's a whole kind of like serious line of the X-Files that's been taken there, so if it continues on from whatever happens as a result of the storyline in season 10 at the moment in terms of re-establishing the characters and stuff, then it's just, I'm finding it kind of hard to believe how they could operate in the same world. I can just about deal with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles operating in the same world as X-Files, but only if they're a bit more realistic.
Well,
and The Crow would work. But Ghostbusters and Transformers is a bit...
The worrying thing is, though, is that isn't Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles meant to be set in New York? Which is the same area as Ghostbusters. Yeah, so why haven't they crossed over before if they're in the same universe?
I mean, it's not completely... I wouldn't say it's completely clear how the crossovers are going to work, but it does seem like the non-X-Files properties will be somehow present in their world in one form or another.
Yeah.
If I was feeling cynical, which I never am, I'd say how they're going to work is... extraordinarily badly and very cynically.
Is it going to be as far-fetched as IDW's Doctor Who and Star Trek crossover from the other year?
Well, at least that kind of made sense because alternate universes and time travel and...
I would say that...
We're willing to sort of suspend that bollocks.
I think Turtles and Crow could definitely work in X-Files universe, because there's stuff that's happened before that kind of makes sense from a genetic mutant freak that happened in the TV series, which is Turtles.
If it was a sort of X-Files type spin on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, then I'd still be raising an eyebrow and frowning.
And the crew still works, because they've heard storylines about ghostly goings-on causing effects in the real world anyway, in at least one, if not more, episodes of the original X-Files.
I know, it seems a little bit too much for me. But they could prove me wrong and it might actually turn out to tie in quite nicely. But when I heard that you know, they were actually saying about the Force, we're looking for this company that both bus ghosts, are they kind people and stuff? I was just thinking, really? You're going down that route?
I think I'm going to give it a look. in January when it comes when the first one comes out.
I mean, I'm going to
just poke it with a stick from very far away and see.
I mean, it could work if it kind of came out something similar to Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, when you're kind of sticking in just like random like bits and you're just kind of creating this kind of amalgam of different universes and just basically being rather comedic with it. But if you're setting it primarily in the X-Files universe, that's going to be a bit difficult.
Well, you say comedic, but it looks like the Lone Gunmen are going to be the main characters for the beginnings of the crossover.
Yeah.
And they're a slight source of humour as it is. So it might not be difficult for funny things to happen.
True.
This is true.
on that ground,
I could see Donatello becoming an honorary member of the Lone Gunman with his little IT rares.
I'm going to move us on to...
Everyone knows Michelangelo was the best.
I'm moving us on. No,
he wasn't.
Guys.
Donatello was.
No turtles arguments.
Donatello
would
kick his ass.
No.
To be honest, I quite like Raphael.
Behave, gentlemen. Behave.
Michelangelo is
Raphael.
A dude.
Raphael had an attitude problem.
True.
Look, we're going to talk about Microsoft Xbox One game profiles and social features. We are not going to argue for turtles.
Because someone has to.
God damn it. Take minds out of turtles. Does that work?
That just makes it sound worse.
You see, take your mind out of the gutter kind of would work in that instance.
Surely.
No.
Out of the radioactive goo.
Okay, has anyone seen the video that Microsoft released last week in regards to their Xbox One gamer profiles and social features? And just how too much it's all looking?
I've seen pictures of it. I haven't actually seen the video, and I quite like the idea of being able to follow somebody like you would on Twitter, so you can expand your friends list a little bit more. That sounds quite cool.
It needs expanded, the friends list.
Definitely. It does, yeah. And the following option seems to be a logical way of going forward.
I don't know,
don't say going forward. Oh.
I know, I think that's a bit of a cop-out, to be honest, because, I mean, why can't they just expand the friends list? You know, because presumably there's got to be a difference between the friends list and the followers, and presumably the followers... Yeah, can't kind of set up matches online with. So it's kind of, yeah.
You might be able to view public videos.
No. Just had a horrible, horrible thought.
Go on.
It's probably a thought that someone had in a Microsoft boardroom and everyone said, excellent idea, how do we monetize it?
How do you get celebrities to be on Xbox? Give them followers. Oh, no. Lady Gaga. Justin Bieber is challenging you to a game of COD.
Now, you see, I would savour the opportunity to shoot Justin Bieber in the head.
But how emasculated and humiliated would you feel if you lost to him?
I don't think that would happen, to be honest, because I've got opposable thumbs. I've evolved that far.
But saying that, he's got enough money to actually hire somebody to play
exactly.
Game assassin?
Yeah, game assassin. There you go. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I think the whole thing leads me to question whether or not the situation with the API for Xbox One's social and sort of gamer tag profiles and everything will be open enough so that services like Raptor will continue. Because I like my Raptor. I like it a lot.
It will have to be open to a degree because they've... they've been a lot more open with it on 360 than Sony have been with PSN. Because if you recall, there's a lot of stuff out there which has, you've got this achievement, or this achievement is worth such and such because it's hard to get. And 360 Voice, where it's an automated blog based on achievements and how long you've spent on the marketplace and things like that. Yeah. All that kind of thing exists because they've made it open. There's not really like that for the PlayStation Network because Sony haven't. Now, obviously, I think this generation, Sony have learned a lot from the things they did with the PS3. And I can kind of see that with a Vita, even though I seriously don't want games posting updates on Facebook when I get trophies.
Yeah. Go on. You know you it's do. Like, you know you want to wind everybody up with that.
You see, Retroid
earned a trophy in Pinball Arcade. Sony died in a fire when Retroid found that Sony posted on Facebook about him getting a trophy.
See, I've been worried that I'm peeving people off on my Facebook because I keep on posting pictures from Wind Waker on Facebook.
No, that's fine, because that's it's fine. Something you're doing. It's exactly. Not automated.
And it's amazingly brilliant. You know, I just like being able to kind of post.
I like the expressions you keep putting on Link's face because he absolutely. Looks so funny. But going back to the Raptor,
they just were excellent 10 years ago.
Going back to the.
I'm just going to keep doing that.
Going back to the issue with third party service providers.
Poor dead horse.
Accessing Xbox One.
Yep.
And the, its back end, indeed, obviously, PlayStation 4's back end. In order to provide services similar or better than what they're doing now. The whole thing with the sort of like the followers and stuff on Xbox One. Well, the thing is, Raptor already has a thing like that itself.
Yep.
So I'd be kind of worried with the crossover that could create. If you're
It's a classic Microsoft maneuver, isn't it? They wait for, you know, they kind of open things up a little bit, wait for someone else to have better ideas and do interesting things, and then just take them.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Raptor haven't said anything since September as to, you know, in the beginning of September at that, as to whether or not there's a chance of them being compatible with Xbox One's gamer profiles, let alone PlayStation 4's. But, I mean, the guy did talk about, and I think that's the CEO, he did kind of talk about the fact that PSN was kind of, and has been pretty piss poor for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been very closed.
Because they can't even update automatically. You have to log into Raptor after you've played the PSN games to update the trophies.
I think it's kind of weird how this console, well, this coming console generation, they've got a lot more kind of social features where you're actually putting like game content onto the web in a way. It's a bit weird.
They seem to... The thing is that they seem to think that everyone wants to share everything. Now, this was perhaps the case a year and a half ago before the whole NSA thing obviously happened this year with the Snowden leaks and the whole people now getting slightly more conscious about sharing of information. Also, the social networks they're hooking these services up to anyway, so say your stuff auto-posts to Twitter or Facebook.
Which I hate auto-posting.
Sorry.
A lot of younger people are actually moving away from these networks already.
Mm.
So you're going to get auto-posting. I can't quote the actual stats and stuff, but due to the research I do at work, I'm seeing a lot of data lately about how people are not using what people consider to be the main social networks as much anymore. And something like, even in the UK, like, and this is not just teenagers, this is like everyone, like a third of UK social media users aren't on, I think, any major social network. Seriously? The five. So that was like Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, YouTube, and somebody else.
Google Plus?
Either Google Plus or LinkedIn, maybe.
Hmm.
And obviously you wouldn't want game updates on LinkedIn.
Sorry?
You wouldn't want gameplay updates going on your LinkedIn profile.
No, that's very true.
But yeah, so it's just this whole idea of sort of like, oh, you're sharing to blah blah networks, and it's Facebook isn't acquiring as many users as it used to and stuff. So it's kind of like
people of the world.
It's like, oh, we're gonna launch with all these features and that, and I'm like, well, I hope you've got an update for a year and a half or so down the line when you realise people aren't using these features and are perhaps on other networks.
Well, all these things are, all these services have APIs. And they'll be hooked into all that kind of thing. So they'll be wanting to get people drawn in. Because, unless they use backward compatibility. Oh, wait.
No.
Neither of them have it, and the cloud can just fuck off. To be succinct. But they, you know, they want to get involved and see, oh, you know, do that. like if you've seen adverts for things like Command and Conquer, and you know they've got the little picture in picture of you know other people playing, and it's like, you know, trash talk with your friends if you are American, because no one else seems to do that, because everyone else gets on far better than Americans do.
Yeah, that's British. We go jolly good game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird experience playing with Europeans and Americans, because the Americans are, you know, on the whole, very adversarial and, you know, hostile in a sort of gameplay way. And in general, Europeans are, you know, that was a good game, thanks.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, is I can't imagine myself wanting to see just updates of what, about what people are doing from a gaming perspective. So the whole followers concept, while I don't actually have, even though this is the facility on Raptor, for instance, I don't have that many followers. I'm mostly friends with people on it who are also on multiple services. So like Steam plus something. So it's just kind of like, well, I don't really follow. You know, the people I connect with when it comes to gaming tend to be people that I've got a slight interest in actually playing multiplayer with. The whole idea of having a level reduced from that just doesn't strike me as particularly useful.
There's a whole slew of the social things which I'm not sure about. But yeah,
as Paul was saying, it would have made more sense to have increased the amount of people you could have as actual friends.
And introduced clans, for God's sake.
Yes.
Yes.
That would have been great, but there's no sign of that at all at the moment.
They've been hinting at clan support for years.
And they'll carry on hinting.
Yeah. And oh, remember when they turned off Xbox Live for the original Xbox? You know, the real Xbox One.
Yes.
And this is so we can do all sorts of cool stuff with Live on the 360, which we haven't done at all.
And it doesn't look like they're necessarily going to do for the Xbox One, because all they seem to think everyone wants is social media with their games.
It honestly looks like there's something that they've kind of, lots of ads. They've noticed, oh, people are using lots of social networks, and you can do these in social networks. Let's do these as well. So I don't really care.
If I'm gaming, I'm gaming. That's the end of it. I just want to carry on playing the game.
People use social networks because that's where the people they know are.
Yeah.
They're social and they're networks. I don't want to cultivate a following or whatever on Xbox One version of Live. I don't care. And by and large, the people that I know on these social networks, I'll, you know, talk about games and such, but I'm not going to want updates on everything I bloody well do. There's some crossover, but there's, you know, by and large, they're separate things. So it's just. This whole you know, recording video and things like that. Really?
You see, I don't mind recording video in general, and then but then doing something with it before giving it to the public.
Absolutely. So if it was recording
it as a thing rather than just I can record the last 5 or 10 minutes of gameplay.
I think they've kind of missed the point of Let's Plays.
Yeah,
they have. They have, and it's just I'm gonna be staying away from YouTube for, you know, around about the launch of, you know, both machines. Or around about, you know, when they both actually have these features turned on, because I don't think the Xbox One is going to have it from launch.
But, I mean, with these, you know, kind of clips, they're more for, well, like On Live was meant to have, which was like bragging rights type thing. Oh, I've done this awesome achievement and whatnot. And it's like, I don't really care. I'd be more interested in kind of seeing something that's amusing or funny or, you know, something like that.
See, I quite like the idea of when the PS4, I saw the advert interface, and the guy was playing a game and he got stuck, and he noticed that one of his friends had just got past that bit, so he asked them how he did it, and they just sent him the video clip of the last 10 minutes and showed him how to get past the bit that he was stuck on. Quite like the idea of that. that works.
Yeah, but couldn't he just say, well, you go over to the rock over there?
No, because he's busy playing Killzone. Give him a chance.
But there again, but I mean, presumably you wouldn't have your entire game stream, so you'd have to choose like sections to upload or something.
Yeah. Well, he just sent it as a video message on the trailer, I think. But I thought that was a pretty cool idea, especially if you sent it over because you're then going to work or something, and then you can catch up later for some co-op or something. I thought that was pretty cool how you can help people out with it.
I know, I think maybe a better option would be to have almost like ghosts. So, you know, like in like racing games where you have like a ghost.
Mm.
If you have kind of that, but connected with your friends instead, so that if there is a place where you can't get past, you know, for whatever reason, you can, you know, kind of view your friend's ghost so that you don't actually have to leave the game.
Like the super guides in the 3DS version of Donkey Kong and stuff.
Well, it's not just that, but I'm just thinking now about the tip system that's in several Wii U games.
Well, it started out on the Wii, didn't it?
Did it start on the Wii? I thought it was Wii U. It started out on...
You want
to... No, because I think it was in like Mario Galaxy 2 as well, wasn't it?
Was it in Mario Galaxy 2?
I think so. Anyway, yeah.
But the tip system that Nintendo have developed, how about that? I think I kind of prefer that. I mean, obviously, you could perhaps on purpose have this multimedia element where then you did do so much video of what you've just done and stick it in a place that if somebody else was playing, they could... like find, look on the screen, it's like, oh, there's a tip here, watch that, then get on with it. At the same time, that the videos and that, they're not necessarily going to have like your audio commentary in that, so it's just going to be you playing, so you still wouldn't necessarily get information across as clearly as you could otherwise do.
Yeah, so say for example, if you come up to this one bit and your friend's passed it by using a specific item that you don't have, you might not necessarily know, you know, about that item, and why is this working for him and not for me?
Meanwhile, going back to the original subject, which was Xbox One and the profile setup that's going to be there. Followers. Who's keen on followers?
I'm not so much.
Crickets.
It's I think it's quite an interesting concept, and I'll wait and see how it goes out. But saying that. No, I won't, because I'm not getting the Xbox.
Also, countdown until you see adverts say, oh, you start getting spam. Get followers. Like you do on Twitter. And it's just,
do you want 3,000 followers? Buy this game.
Yeah, I really want a few hundred robot accounts following me, because it's some kind of weird score type
To be honest, following like accounts, which obviously would be on a slightly public level in comparison to your friends list. I mean, there are privacy settings and stuff that you would be able to mess around with to affect these things, at least at the beginning.
Yeah.
But by having users make connections amongst themselves, it does give Microsoft more data to do things with.
Yeah, it's all about the data, and it's all about keeping people within their ecosystem, because they'll be ripping off features from other social networks, and the important thing is they control this one.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is, though, is that it's kind of competing with other kind of social medias for consoles. So, say, for example, Miiverse, that is actually quite good because, you can use the pad to actually draw stuff as well. And some of the artwork that comes out there.
How long did it take for lots of penises?
Actually, I haven't seen any.
I've seen a single penis.
Seen really cool artwork for all sorts, like Zelda, Mario, you know, Resident Evil.
I'm actually just hoping they're actually going to do what they were rumored to and bring the Miiverse to the 3DS. Because that would make life so much simpler.
Yeah.
I hope they bring PlayStation Home to the Vita and PS4. No, I don't.
I was going to say, you're talking about two different levels there, aren't you? Really? Because the Miiverse just makes... If it gets rid of the friend codes, then hallelujah.
I'm moving us on to our next news story, which was the Terminator 5 thing.
So,
in case you've missed the headlines, basically, Terminator 5 could be more Batman Begins than sequel to Terminator Salvation if the not confirmed but rumoured director Alan Taylor's recent comments are anything to go by. he can't say at the moment whether or not he's working on the film. But he keeps talking like he probably is. But he can't say. But it's all right. And
so what's he talking about?
So it's a bit like, giving a 14-year-old schoolboy or schoolgirl, their dad works in a movie studio or something like that, and he keeps bringing stuff home, and he's like, "Don't tell anyone at school." Like, because that's going to happen. I've got they didn't use those guns in the last film. So, well, the gun in the next one, I'm not going to tell you how I know. I said, "Oh, just shut up. We don't know."
But yeah, he said that he would make it more like...
I may be projecting there.
He says he's going to make it more like Batman Begins rather than continuing with what's happened with the franchise. You know, I had the misfortune of...
The Terminator's going to fight Liam Neeson?
I had the misfortune of seeing bits of Terminator Salvation last night due to channel hopping. I was not happy with seeing bits again of Terminator Salvation.
I saw it in the cinema. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I don't really want to watch it again.
No. It's good that you watched it once, because otherwise, if you didn't watch it at all, then you'd be like, you know what? I haven't seen that film. I don't know whether it's good or not. I'll watch it, and then you'll find out that it's bad all over again.
I suppose.
It's like having flashbacks.
It's not I was in Nam, it was I was in Terminator Salvation.
To be honest though, it's still not Catwoman levels. That's the thing.
No.
It's just a ridiculously...
mediocre.
Yeah.
Which Batman was it with Arnold Schwarzenegger as...
Batman and Robin.
Go away.
Yeah, I saw that in the cinema. I think that trumps it.
Don't bring that up, please. It's feeling
and
chilly.
And Uma Thurman being crap in a film. That's just not right.
It's still looking like that. Whichever production company that Megan Ellison and whatnot are kind of behind are looking to sort of bring the film out in June 2015. At least that's the rumour. It's all rumour, because nobody's confirming anything at the moment.
I love the fact that they're still making films in actual dates set after the apocalypse.
Yep. At least according
to... So what's actually happening is Skynet is making its own fanfic.
I don't like the idea in some ways more so of them rebooting Terminator. I wouldn't mind them kind of doing a soft reboot where we basically ignore Terminators 3 and 4 and you just kind of go for two
onwards.
Yeah,
if you can get rid of those, that'd be ace.
Yeah.
I mean, To be fair, I think a lot of people
kind of ignore those ones anyway, and they're just like, oh, the Terminator films, what, you mean 1 and 2?
Yep, those are the only ones.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Highlander 2.
Highlander 2?
Yeah.
No, what you said doesn't make sense. There's Highlander.
I was quite happy with the reboot of Batman when it happened with Nolan and that, because
it wasn't hard to get better.
It was a really decent reboot, and I really enjoyed that trilogy.
But this was mostly because I don't like Tim Burton's films much.
I actually do like Tim Burton's Batman films. It's when Joel Schumacher took over the helm and turned it all into a fucking gay camp parade.
I don't like Burton stuff because once you've watched Beetlejuice, you've pretty much seen any Tim Burton film that can ever be made, ever, in that film.
I like Beetlejuice and Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, Before Christmas.
And Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, those are the ones that I could probably live without most others. Oh, Mars Attacks. But that's about it.
I did enjoy Batman and Batman Returns. It was the other lot that ruined it for me.
The best thing that came out of the original Batman, the Tim Burton Batman, was the Bat Pack for the Amiga 500.
Oh, that's
bad. That was a cool game. That was a cool game.
But going back to the situation of T5, what if it was a complete reboot.
Now, it depends, because I was just going to say the beauty of the franchise, and I do want to kill myself for calling it that, but that's what it is because it's time travel and rewriting history. You could stay reasonably true to it while rebooting it, and it wouldn't be a reboot, but it would.
Yeah, true.
Because all that would have to happen would be another Terminator had been... Because, after all, you don't know how many Terminators were sent through.
Could be a paradox.
Yeah, where it could just be... yeah, even a paradox about, you know, which Terminator... You know, if one of the Terminators was sent back to a reasonably random time, that could just keep cropping up. Because, each one could actually happen.
So long as we don't end up with... essentially would be an extended version of that DS9 episode where they go and deal with all the tribbles. So as we end up with an extended version of that,
I like
with
that.
The Terminators.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
It's just the whole tribbles. It's just the whole Jackie, idea of, because obviously then you'd be using the original footage and then superimposing somewhere people hiding from people. Constantly.
Trying not
to alter certain parts of the timeline or something, although they're trying to alter certain parts of the timeline whilst avoiding other parts, and it's just like, we don't need that. Don't need that at all.
Did you really not like that episode then?
I could deal with it for a TV episode, but for an entire film, no.
They wouldn't do that. They'd spend far too much money on it, and it would end up looking worse than the original Terminator.
I mean the other thing is with, I suppose really, J.J. Abrams has opened up the ideas for this, hasn't he? With the way he did the original Star Trek and how he changed that.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because, altering the reality in that, that's quite possible in the Terminator universe as well.
If I haven't said before, he's on my list.
You've got a list?
He's got a list.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. People who have to die because of what they've done to things I like.
See,
Michael Bay is on there as well for the Transformers films.
Yeah. Although I did watch a decent film of his the other day, The Rock. I thought I quite enjoyed that. I still do.
I saw Armageddon when it was on TV over the last week or two. Where I was shouting at the screen at all the... You know, I'm not a NASA scientist and I know that's bollocks. And one of the shuttles has crashed on this asteroid, and one of the people astronauts has died because a rock or a bit of metal hit his faceplate in his suit, and one of them is going, "Oh God, my friend's dead," and there are fires in the background. Oh, they're special space fires that don't require oxygen. Anyway.
I want to just take this back.
That didn't bother me at all. That film.
I want to just take this back to Terminator before I move us on. If that's allowed. Just to say, I think if they avoid having an overly sexed female Terminator in the fifth film.
That was perfect.
And if they could also avoid the mistake of having two protagonists, which is what happened in the fourth film.
Two antagonists is good.
Protagonists doesn't work.
No. I will say, in its defence, Terminator 3, was it? Yeah. I think Terminator 3. There were two things I liked about Terminator 3. One, I'm sorry, but... No spoilers, because you should have seen this by now anyway, even if you didn't want to. One, it wasn't John Connor that the Terminator was sent back to save.
Yeah.
And two, the apocalypse did happen at the end. Those were about the two things that I thought were good about the film. The rest of it was pretty bad.
I think part of the problem was the feel of the film, the aesthetic feel, because the first two, they were very, they're like mostly at night or, they felt very kind of dark. Mm. And the third one, most of it, I remember being in daylight.
Except for that whole veterinary scenes when things could get patched up or whatever. Yeah.
But also, it's just a problem with the first film, Arnie as a Terminator was unstoppable.
Mm.
Yeah.
It was effectively a walking panzer tank in skin. And that's why it was so bad that, and they had to, get away from it.
Yeah.
I mean, the police precinct.
Yes.
And in Terminator 2, you had a Porsche Terminator, where it was very slick, but still incredibly deadly. And then in Terminator 3, it was just bang, slap, how many things can we, throw at these and still not feel actually that dangerous. and then Salvation was just awful.
What I thought might have been quite a nice kind of thing to do would be to have John Connor as actually like an identity that kind of gets passed on, possibly.
Or like Ace Rimmer.
Yeah, that type of thing.
Or Caesar.
But yeah, I thought that might have been, that could be quite a good touch.
Cool.
Maybe, well, I doubt if many people will share that opinion.
I would like to end our news for this week with the, I suppose, biggest piece of gaming news to come out this past week.
Nah.
Or not come out.
Or not come out, in a way, because of its potential effect.
Or just to piss every gamer off and then we're leaving bloody world. Yeah.
So, in case you've somehow not heard, Watch Dogs has been delayed until at least spring 2014. This was announced during Ubisoft's latest financial results call, where President Yves Guillemot said, "Today we can say we already have a great game in hand. Still, in a world of mega blockbusters, we have now come to the conclusion that the team needed additional time to realise the game's full potential." The Watch Dogs wasn't the only game that's been delayed. The Crew has also been affected, apparently. And in light of the financial call, because it wasn't just the delays that were announced, they had not sold as well for several games, including like Splinter Cell Blacklist. And after the call, their shares dropped by 25%.
Which is a little bit...
To be fair, yeah. I mean, a lot of people will kind of turn around and say, no, this is a terrible idea. This is absolutely dreadful. But by the same token, I'd rather have a polished game which was delayed than a game which could be good if they would have actually stuck the extra effort in.
But it also...
Yes.
But it also means that obviously for next-gen launches, launch lineup for both PS4 and Xbox One now looking less strong, because if there was one game that was going to provide variety, it was going to be Watch Dogs.
Because Watch Dogs being developed for the 360 and PS3 as well, it was still fairly kind of weak link in that respect.
Yeah, but then they're leading with a bunch of games that are cross-platform.
Yeah.
At the moment, there's very few exclusives that they're launching with.
I know the PS4, even now, the pre-orders are quite strong for it. The Xbox One, not so much. And I'm beginning to wonder, after the initial launch, are they going to actually sell that many? Because at the moment, there's virtually, there's only a handful of games that I'd even consider buying that are exclusives for them.
Yeah.
Which we've debated before.
Yeah.
The PS4 has lost that one, lost one of his own as well, Drive Club.
Yes.
That's been delayed as well now, isn't it? Which is a shame.
I know a few people who were a little bit and ah about their pre-orders after the Eurogamer Expo and seeing what the games were like.
Mm.
And now, well, yeah.
I mean, I do hope it's as polished effort that they're saying it's going to be, and I do trust, well, Ubisoft have been quite good the last couple of years for good quality titles, but there's one
Assassin's
game,
Assassin's Creed 3.
I love that game.
What's
wrong with Assassin's Creed 3?
Everything being very low level, being very spread out, and their excellent PC version which grinds to a halt in Boston and crashes.
Well, see, mine doesn't crash because mine's on 360. No.
Well, I've got it on PlayStation Plus on PS3, so I might give it a go or not, but it's just...
But there is only one game that really sticks to my mind that was doing this a lot.
Is it Resogun?
No, the game that was getting delayed and promises and that, and that was Duke Nukem Forever.
Nothing's going to be Duke Nukem, but to be honest, Half-Life, currently Half-Life 3 is slowly working its way into Duke Nukem Forever territory. But going back to Watch Dogs and the situation that Ubisoft has put themselves in, the idea of the whole, they've come to the conclusion that the team needed additional time to realise the game's full potential. Now, was that really the team, or was that management, or was that somebody above management? And then obviously because things were looking quite subversive and sort of a lot of the gameplay elements were not necessarily things that you would find in many other games, does that mean that they're going to try and mainstream it a bit more
in order
to sell it?
I think they're going to put more in, and maybe it's coincidence, but I wonder if it's got anything to do with Grand Theft Auto 5, which has got a lot of lot of things to do in a world.
Yeah. But then, of course,
and I wonder if if they've taken one look and thought, can we add a little bit more? Because
The other thing that crossed my mind though was that was going to be launched very close to their other big title, Assassin's Creed 4.
That's also been raised. Yeah.
You know, it seems very, very.
For them to have two open world
games at the same time.
Yeah, from the same publisher.
Yeah.
I think one of the telling things, though, is that because obviously there's a reason why a lot of games are skipping the Wii U, and that's basically because Wii U has such a small, install base. And
there are other reasons as well, but yes. I know that wasn't me being snarky. That wasn't me being snarky. it really wasn't, I swear.
Okay.
But go on.
But yeah, it's with because obviously they're kind of dealing with figures and kind of crossing them between PS3 and Xbox 360 versions of the games for the sales figures. And it's like but Xbox 360 and PS3 already have established install bases. They're not going to get that much larger.
Yeah.
So, and obviously, there's going to be some people that will get a PS4 and an Xbox One, but they may actually find that developing those games may be, quite costly as well. So I'm just kind of wondering whether they're actually going to figure out that maybe their targets for actually, kind of sales of the games maybe actually a bit too high, possibly.
I think in a market that's increasingly segmented, that the figures boards essentially are after the people making the investments, the people giving the eventual say so and get things done, but their expectations of how much a game will sell are perhaps unrealistic now in an age where, I'm going to blame the internet, where in an age where the internet has kind of really helped to divide people's attention. For a game that's potentially got probably more than, say, 10 or 15 hours gameplay, so it was more than 20 hours gameplay, I would say that the market's been reduced due to the availability of other forms of entertainment.
Bearing in mind that I've actually seen some of the prices for games for the Xbox One and PS4, like on stuff like Amazon and other retailers and whatnot, and they are actually quite high in comparison. You're looking at like maybe £5 to £10 more expensive than even the Wii U version at times.
They always try that on a new launch though.
And I think that's seriously going to affect game sales as well.
It is, yeah.
I think what they're going to have to do is there's going to have to be a drive to push games to the next gen and for the price of those machines to come down a bit faster than the platform holders would necessarily like.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more cross-platform stuff. There's going to be... I think Sony have got the right idea when it comes to the Vita with cross-buy, because that's a good way of... giving of not that much extra effort, because they made things very easy to port.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you get the same thing again. So, you've got more of a tie-in. It's going to be incentive.
Can I just ask, what games are actually going to be supporting that, you know, cross, what is it, cross-play?
Cross, yeah.
Well, there's cross-buy, which I've got a few games with, for example, Limbo. I downloaded that for PS3, and I recently got a Vita, and I've got the Vita version for free.
Okay.
And there was a pool, game as well that did that, and the first Sony title that did that was their All-Star Battle Royale, was it?
Yeah, but let us not speak of All-Star Battle Royale. But there are things like the pinball games, Zen Pinball 2 and Pinball Arcade. If you buy tables on one, you also get them on the other.
Okay. That's
one of the drives to me. For example, you know, with Android or iOS, you buy them for your account, and then if you use your account on a different machine,
you can download.
You have those games again.
Yeah.
So to me, it's a good incentive.
It is.
To you know, you can buy for one and then get for the other, and if you get the other machine later on, you already have those.
True, but what I would say is that. Obviously, that's going to be, there's going to be a technical limitation because obviously you would be able to play, you know, the new PS4 games in, you know, whatever glory and whatnot on your PS Vita because it just wouldn't be strong enough to, be able to play that. So
Aren't they doing the, if you like, was it Call of Duty Ghosts, if you buy it for the PS3 and you upgrade to the PS4, you can then buy the PS4 version for like a tenner.
What I was going to say was, I know it's through the cloud. I know. But remote play is going to be a standard thing on the PS4.
Yes.
So it's going to be supported in the OS. It's not going to be game optional, unless obviously something uses, you know, the Move camera or, you know, anything like that. You will be able to pick up the Vita and play that like the, the Wii U controller screen.
Gamepad.
Yeah. So are you going to be able to do that? So you know, that's their way of tying in things. But it's all about the incentivizing. And so, you know, cross-play, cross-buy, I can see that being more of a feature. And Sony seem to have really upped their game on making it easy for developers to, if you're doing it on this, you at more or less the same time, you can build a version for the Vita.
Or at least have some sort of software that, you know, can kind of, you know, do a version for the Vita automatically, maybe.
That kind of thing. And I quite like that kind of idea. But, they're going to have to do some... I mean, you know, there's PlayStation Plus and there's the god-awful out-of-date, you know, games for gold games that Microsoft are doing. Yeah.
Magic the Gathering.
They're going to have to... you know, put more lollipops on the table to get people to keep using their machines and buying.
I just want to bring us back to the issue with Watch Dogs, though, being delayed again before I...
Yeah. It was kind of on the topic of that.
Yeah. I do genuinely feel that they have now lost the balance of releases that they would have had before Christmas this year.
It doesn't look... Watch Dogs was the one that I know a lot of people were going for. That was going to be there. Yeah, I know it's coming out on current machines as well as Xbone and PS4 and PC. But you know that was the one where it's like, I quite like the idea of that. And now it's been pushed back. There's far less reason for them to really want the machine this Christmas.
To be fair, as a Wii U owner, I'm kind of glad because I am slightly interested in Watch Dogs, but I do realise that there's going to be some really good games out. Say, I think they're really good games. You guys are probably going to disagree, but obviously, I think Sonic Lost World, I was kind of interested in that. I think it has released already, but yeah.
I've seen a review of it. Eurogamer has had a review.
Don't always trust it.
I suggest, no partisanship here, but I suggest you go have a look at the Eurogamer review.
At the same time, I've been hearing a lot of mixed reviews.
I suggest you look at the 3DS version first, from what I've been told.
They've also got a review of the 3DS version.
But yeah, there's also, was it Super Mario 3D World, That's due out, I think it's November 29th or so. And I am actually quite interested in the Wii Sports HD stuff as well. That seems quite cool.
I'm looking forward to the new 3DS Zelda. Yay!
Mm. Now, I was going to say, you were kind of on topic, you know, with the cross-buy, cross-play thing. I wish Nintendo would do that.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
I would be a lot more inclined to buy stuff digitally from Nintendo if it was in a virtual console.
I have to admit, now got two versions of Kirby's Dream Land because of this.
Yeah, one on 3DS, one on Wii.
Yeah.
I think another thing that I would actually love Nintendo to do is actually do bundles as well, because I know, you know, there's... How many Mega Man games are there on the Wii U Virtual Console? It's absolutely loads.
Yeah.
You know, there's at least, you know, 4 or 5 or something like that. And also the Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons. I reckon those should have come as a bundle as well. Even if it was obviously, you know, slightly higher price than a single game. But, you know, you should do it as a bundle.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Because I would love to be able to... You know, like Animal Crossing, the original Animal Crossing the original Western release of Animal Crossing on GameCube, where you could plug in your Game Boy Advance with using the link cable, and you could download the NES games from it.
Yeah.
And play them on that. Now, I would love this would, you know, get me, you know, something like a Wii U, if I could get Virtual Console things and then, you know, squeeze them down the pipe onto my 3DS.
That'd be cool.
But, you know, it needs more incentive. You know, even in comparison with the current gen stuff, that's why I still don't have a Wii U. There's not enough incentive. And things like, you know, Watch Dogs and, you know, the cross releases that they're doing, wouldn't it be great if they said, you know, come the new year, in about like March, April or something, you know, if you want to, you know, if you bought Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag, upgrade to a digital version of it, you know, if you bought, you know, PS4 or, you know, Xbox One, and, you know, play it in, you know, Uber HD.
Yeah.
And transfer everything over.
That'd be cool.
Please do that.
I'd love to be able to transfer like a game, you know, a bit like what happened with Monster Hunter 3. But yeah, anyway, I think Emily wants to get on to.
Yeah, I was gonna move us on to a feature this week, which is this interview. So last week I talked with Paul Leonard Morgan about his work on the score for Dread and Limitless, how he became a composer for films, his first video game project, which has a pretty big piece of news in it that he can't name, and his thoughts on geek culture. So listen and enjoy, and we'll be back afterwards to give you some more details, like our Halloween competition and stuff. Were you composing while the Dread film was being obviously filmed and put into post, or was it all done sort of during post, or all done during post? Just Dread, I think, in particular.
The Dread in particular, it was all shot, because it was all shot in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all shot by the time that I came on board. But then we were in post-production, so they were kind of editing down in London, and they were showing me kind of various rough cuts, but I mean, there was so much kind of, you know, special effects going on it. So for example, you know, you got, peach trees, the actual tower block itself. So the first viewing that I had of it, I think there were 3 levels of it, and then every time they would send me another cut, there'd be like another 2 levels, and it kept on getting higher and higher and higher and higher and higher. So it's really weird seeing it like that. So the only actual shooting that they had to do, they kind of redid a couple of bits. You know, there's a new kind of ending, and there are a couple of bits during the film that they did a bit of reshooting for. But in general, it was all shot by the time that I came on board.
How did you get into creating music for film scores? Because it's kind of an interesting area to kind of fall into. Because I saw you went to one of the Royal Academies, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to the Royal Scottish Academy of Music to learn film music, which is kind of a bizarre thing to try and learn. And the guy buggered off to Hollywood after a term anyway. but I started working with quite a lot of bands in Glasgow, because like Glasgow had really thriving music scenes, kind of Mogwai and Bell and Sebastian, it was Snow Patrol, Arab Strap, Franz Ferdinand, Travis, you know, it was quite an underground kind of scene. And then, so my studio was at the back of the studio, basically the main studio in Glasgow that all the bands worked at. So they give me a shout and say, can you come and do some string arrangements? Can you come and do some brass arrangements? Isabel Campbell, who's from Bell and Sebastian, got to know her really well. And then some of the filmmakers heard some of the stuff I was doing with the bands and were like, oh, this is quite cool. Do you want to come and do a short film? Or so I was like, yeah, no, it sounds like fun. And then, I don't know, the bands like the fact that you work with filmmakers and filmmakers like the fact that you work with bands. And I don't know, it just seemed to have kind of took off from there, really. I did an ITV drama called Fallen, and then the director from that went on to Spooks, and so I got this Spooks gig, and then I started doing some kind of feature films just in the UK, kind of low-budget indie ones. And then, yeah, kind of went off to the States for a bit of work, and then got this film Limitless when I was out there. So I don't know, it's just kind of a natural progression. I think it wasn't just for film music. I always wanted to write music. I've always written music. I just seem to have fallen into it, kind of thing.
Okay, that's fair enough. Do you find yourself sort of going towards SF or sort of science fiction films perhaps a little bit more than any other genre, or is it just you just happen to have worked on Limitless and Dread?
Do you know what? I was talking to someone the other day about this. I was like, I'm not a total fanboy. I'm not a total geek. But I did, you know, used to get all my comics and all my Dreads and stuff, but I was never kind of this humongous kind of serial stalker fan. But having worked on Dread, I suddenly really got into it again. And, you know, you do sort of like, you visit sort of various sites, but more than that, it's kind of when you just discuss it, you suddenly realise so many other people are into it. And I think it used to be quite a British phenomenon, the kind of new comic books. And now, with America, it's kind of totally taken off. And that's where, you know, obviously, about 90% of the big films are at the moment anyway, with the Avengers and everything else. But it's just interesting how mainstream it's all become.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, I don't have to hide the fact that I do like the old comic book as much anymore, which is quite nice.
Are you a big geek or a medium geek?
I would say medium geek, because I try to create stuff as well. So, because I've got a short comic published, I've got a one-shot going out hopefully next year. So I'm more interested in the craft rather than just kind of obsessing over, I don't know, like the chronology of Thor or something like that, you know.
But I tell you what's really weird is like some of these directors that meet in LA, they seem totally, inverted commas, normal. Comic-Con comes along and they all just go up there, get dressed up, go up for a week, and you know, they live the Comic-Con dream. But I'd never realised what a big deal it was until about kind of three, four years ago when I went to LA, and suddenly like how massive a deal Comic-Con is, and people just getting again kind of dressed up as part of it all, and it's the whole experience. And I think it's got so commercial now. Again, you know, it's all become mainstream.
Going back to Dread for a moment, what was it about like the footage that you were being shown with Dread and all the rushes and everything that made you go really bassy with it? It's like the bass on it is so lovely, and I'm not sure if you realise, but you tweeted at me once about it.
Need more bass. It's like, it's. Do you know what it is? It's. I mean, we went through various kind of stages of how do we want this film to be, because obviously, I was brought in quite early on in the edit, so we're trying to work out what kind of sound to have, and the first thing that I thought when I saw it is this isn't a glossy Hollywood film. You know, it had a fairly healthy budget for a British film, but it wasn't a big glossy Hollywood film. It didn't suit big orchestras, big this, big that. You know, it felt just really gritty and really urban to me. You know, and I was chatting away to Alex, and I think to begin with I said, yeah, I just picture it really guitar kind of led. So we did a version of the score which was pretty guitar-y. And then we're like, yeah, that's good. Then I started mucking around with these old analog synths, and it was when I was working on some of the slow-mo stuff that I really started getting into kind of all, you know, I've got God knows how many kind of analog synths around. And I just started getting into it. The soundtrack was pretty much finished by then. And we're sort of like, do you know what? This sounds really cool. Let's try putting this in. And suddenly it was the, what was it? The Marmar clan, the Rise of Marmar.
Yeah.
And it had this real kind of throbbing like, doo 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 doo, and then got some kind of old school drums over it. And it just totally changed the way that I was suddenly looking at the soundtrack. And I just went back and revisited the entire thing. I said, look, you know, put the dub back by another month. I want to go back and revisit. And I suddenly just started mucking around with kind of, you know, sine basses, synth basses, distorted basses, fuzz basses. And it just had this real energy to it without doing too much. And Alex was the one, Alex just said, that bass riff that you've got going there, he said, that is Dread's theme. And a couple of the producers were like, that's not a theme. I'm like, no, believe me, that's a theme. This is the new school theme. And yeah, I mean, so we just started getting into the bass, and it just felt the throbbingness of it, the poundingness of it. It was as natural a raw sound as you could get. And for some reason, it just seemed to fit really well with this kind of raw, dirty, you know, cinema scape that you got in front of you.
I know that, because I've read a couple of interviews that you were in previously, but have you seen the Stallone film version since doing Dread, or have you still completely avoided it?
I've got no interest in it.
That's fair. That's
as he
fair.
Comes on, walking on with the Zimmer frame. No, I haven't. And you know, and some, it's quite interesting. I mean, the amount of feedback that this score has got from Dread has been quite phenomenal. And some of the people have said, you know, oh, I never thought that, and this is the kind of bizarre thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the film, I think, was universally slated, less one or two people, you know, the first Dread, the Judge Dread. And yet some people like sent me emails going like, oh, I never thought that that score could be better. The Silvestri score is just amazing. But this is just something else. And it's like, well, it's a completely different score and it's a completely different film by the sounds of it. So I don't know how you can kind of go comparing the two. But so no, haven't seen it. I'm not sure that I will probably ever get around to it.
I think you're probably saving yourself some time there by not seeing it. Obviously, film composing, and one would hope that there are perhaps other composers or scores or other film tracks that have like inspired you or you've drawn inspiration from generally. Who or what are they? Anything that's stuck with you?
My listening, apart from that, I don't get a chance to do anybody listening at the moment. My tastes are unbelievably extreme. You know, on the one hand, you've got, I mean, my legends were kind of Ennio Morricone and stuff. So I was a kind of orchestra buff, and I would listen to all of his stuff for the string arrangements when I was working with bands. And then, you know, I go on to Curtis Mayfield. So the scores, you know, The Mission was one of my all-time favorites. I mean, everybody always says that, but genuinely, I remember watching that with my dad and thinking, this is beautiful. Last of the Mohicans, great big rousing orchestral soundtracks. Then you've got the David Arnold Bond soundtracks, which kind of went back old school but had a modern twist with it. The Propellerheads did some drums on, I think, the first one that David Arnold did. But then, you know, you get to the Chemical Brothers with Hannah. I thought that was an absolutely phenomenal soundtrack. And then, again, it's cheesy to say, but it's true. You know, Social Network. What I loved about that soundtrack was the fact that for the first time, getting an Oscar for that kind of music, no one saw it coming. You know, it suddenly means that instead of having to do something that's maybe traditional, all of a sudden it's like, do you know what? This is now accepted that you can try and do something different. And again, you know, a lot of people either love this one or hate it. But for me, Inception, I absolutely adored. It annoys me when you then go and hear everybody just rip it off left, right and center in every single trailer and every single ad and every other soundtrack. But it's it was just really, really powerful and it fitted the film perfectly. So I go right across the board, you know, from electronic stuff. You know, I used to love, obviously, the old John Carpenter films, Getting Back to Dread. And in the old analog stuff, and suddenly Blade Runner and stuff. And that was one of the conversations we had, was how can we do something like that? Because I love the simplicity of the John Carpenter films and the fact that every single note was there for a reason. You know, it might now sound a wee bit dated, some of them, but they would bring out, you know, a gunshot, you know, or someone moves or something like that. And I think that's what I tried to do with the soundtrack, was to kind of do a modern day version of that. It just seemed to fit pretty well.
Okay. Now that it does sound like you've kind of taken in all those influences.
You're saying I've ripped them off, Emily?
No, I'm saying you've taken in those influences. Jeez. I mean, that'd be like me saying that the Wachowski brothers had clearly messed around with, like, Ghost in the Shell, you know, for The Matrix, you know. you're having to watch the footage in order to come up with the ideas of where the sound's going to go. How many times do you tend to end up having to watch a film or an animation in order to kind of get it right, to get what you need in order to do what you do?
Every composer's got their own way of doing it. And I've changed quite a lot, actually, the last couple of years. I used to watch the stuff over and over again as I was composing. So I'd have it on loop in the background, basically, and I'd just be writing out themes and stuff and trying them out and seeing what works. But it gets very easy to get, bored's the wrong phrase, immune to the material. So you're looking at the picture in front of you and the visuals, but you're not actually taking it in after a while because you've seen it so many times. So it's the easiest part is coming up with a theme at the beginning while the visuals are still fresh in your head. The hardest part is coming up with a new theme after you've seen the visuals about 300 times. So recently, I've been kind of watching it 3 or 4 times and then just switching it off, going and writing some tracks, then switching the stuff back on and seeing how the tracks will kind of fit in with the picture and then start taking it from there. But I mean, this animation that I've just been doing has just been bonkers because the animation changes so much the entire time that, you know, you're writing one theme and it seems to suit the visuals really well. And then the next cut they send you has actually got a dinosaur on it, or you know, the Minions, and you can actually make it out that it's the Minions this time. It's like, okay, this has now got a completely different vibe to what I was doing before. I better go back and change that. So for me, you know, in total, you know, if you're working on a film, if you think about it, every cue that you're writing, I don't know, you're probably watching that about, maybe like about 350, 400 times. So you've seen the film in total about 400 times by the time it actually comes around to dub, let alone actually going out to screen. So it's really hard to stay fresh on it.
That sounds intense.
Well, it's just, you know, if you picture, okay, so you take a scene from Dread. So he comes along at the beginning, you've got the Dread 3D logo that crashes in. I'm doing this from the top of my head and I haven't seen it for a year now. And then we go to the bike chase and the bike goes off, yeah?
Yeah.
And there is a woman chatting away in the control room saying, do you need help? Do you need help? And he goes, no, I'm fine. So I can remember that much. And to begin with, I couldn't hear any voice at all with the woman in the kind of call center or whatever saying, do you need help, Dread? And then about the 40th incarnation, suddenly you can hear her voice really clear. And all of a sudden, instead of having really full on music, you've got to dunk the music. So you've got to work a way of actually kind of stripping that out. Mm. So it's going to be enough room for the dialogue. But at the same time, you're really trying to give that cue some energy. You know, to really get people into the film straight away. So it's quite hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. That animation you just mentioned, can you talk about that at all? What is that? Or can you not talk about that at the moment? Like, name it.
What, the dinosaurs one?
Yeah, the dinosaurs one.
Dinosaurs one is called Walking with Dinosaurs 3D, which was apparently, again, haven't seen it, but I've heard of it, was a BBC production about 10 years ago.
Yes, I remember now, yeah.
So Fox and a company called Evergreen in the States have bought the rights to it, and they're turning it into a $100 million movie, which is coming out on December the 20th. So that's been, they've done 3 years kind of doing all the animations for it. It's called photoreal animation, which you, being a geek, will know all about this. I didn't have a clue. So the difference between all the different sorts of animation, this is, they shot all the background in Alaska and New Zealand. And then basically took all that as background. So it's real, you know, it's all being filmed. And then it's like the world's biggest green screen. They just go and superimpose all these animated dinosaurs on top of it, which just looks phenomenal. And after about 5 minutes, you just forget that they're actual animations. It sounds stupid having never seen a dinosaur, but it just looks like real dinosaurs the entire time. It's mental. Whereas something like in the summer, I was working on these little short films for the Minions from Despicable Me 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that was amazing experience because you go from the most basic fundamental animation where you see like the X and Y axis and stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
To suddenly, you know, little pencil drawings, which are beautifully done by these guys in Paris, to suddenly, you know, the last month and a half, the transformation was just phenomenal. They suddenly look like Minions as you and I would know them from Despicable Me, and then they change and change and change until, oh my God, this is the most polished animation out. So that, the transformation came in the last month and a half, whereas this, the transformation has been, you know, throughout the years, kind of as the animation gets better and better on Walking with Dinosaurs.
I think I've got one more question that I'd really like to ask you, and that is, have you actually worked on any video game soundtracks yet?
This is the first one that I'm doing at the moment.
Okay. So
this is a $180 million game for EA Games.
You don't have to name it if you can't.
That's right, because I can't name it.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you anything about it. It's,
okay. So this is
mind-blowing.
Okay, so this is your you are working on your first game project at the moment. Wow. Okay.
I said to them when they approached me, I have to be careful with what I say, but they approached me and I said, well, you know, got to be honest, you know, not the world's biggest gamer. I've played around at some mates' houses and stuff, but my problem is, if I bought a console at the studio, whether it was in LA or whether it was in Glasgow, I would get no work done because I've got such an addictive personality. I would just play it over and over and over and over again. You know, and I remember playing on the old PlayStation, probably 1 or 2 or something, and just what a couple of games of it, was played it over, and I just couldn't put the kind of console down. So I said to them, you know, you're going to have to hold my hand and talk me through the process, and the process is just mental. So they've been amazing at kind of teaching me the ropes and stuff like that, but it's so completely different to working with bands or doing soundtracks and stuff. So it's a big learning curve. It's really cool. It's really good fun. The excitement is, as of yesterday, Dread is coming out on vinyl, which I'm very excited about.
Ooh.
Diane, that works with, she just said she got an email from Metropolis or something. So that's cool. I think it comes out in November. They're doing a limited edition run.
All right, so thanks for listening to the interview.
And I've heard that there might be... Was there like a petition to get a Judge Dredd 2?
There is currently like 2000 AD post about a lot. There is a whole thing, movement going at the moment to try and get a Dredd 2 made. So
that
would be awesome.
Yes, please.
Meanwhile, at the moment, don't forget to enter our Halloween competition. Details for this can be found on the blog post for this episode. We're running with Hex, and you can basically pick up the Trilogy of the Dead original George A. Romero films, plus copies of the novels Stephen King's The Shining and its new sequel, Doctor Sleep. But yeah, this unfortunately is all we've got time for this episode. So it's goodbye from...
It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
It's good night for me, Paul, aka OneArmed_Cookie on Twitter, and you can also find me lurking around thegamejar.com.
It's good night for me, Paul Blewett. I have a website, paul-blewett.com, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. I'm EK6891 on Twitter. You also might want to look at drowningandmultimedia.co.uk. You can find Nerds Assemble over at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google+ as Nerds Assemble Podcast. And obviously, don't forget to check out our sister site, The Hex Dimension, at hexdimension.com. That is all. Good night.
Night.
Good night.
Good night. It's been delayed!